History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to engage, ask a few questions, take the time to listen. You're not going to regret it. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, then to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, and perhaps most importantly, so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Walnut Creek, California is where we have the privilege of visiting with 99-year-old Dick Biagi, a Navy veteran of World War II who survived some pretty close calls aboard the destroyer USS Foreman. We're going to hear about that for sure, and you can find some photos and a short video on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to illustrate it a little further. But to put everything in proper perspective, it always helps to go back to the beginning.
Well, first of all, I was born in Crockett, California, which is across the river from Vallejo. The family moved when I was at a very early age to East Oakland. My mother was a recent immigrant. Spoke absolutely no English. My dad was a World War I Army veteran. He spoke, he had no accent, spoke perfect English. All my mother heard was Italian because he would come home from work and they would converse in Italian. So here I am, all I'm hearing is Italian. So I grew up learning Italian, just absorbed it, Around I guess it was in kindergarten age. There was a grammar school right around the corner, so they decided to send me to school. So I walk around the corner to the grammar school, and a half hour later, I walked right back home with a little note pinned on me. This child cannot attend school until he learns to speak English. That's how far gone I was. So, ironically, I have no memory of learning English. I think at that early age, you just absorb it like a sponge, But anyway, here I am speaking English.
Speaking it very well, and no one would guess you're 99 going on 100. But back to that childhood, I know you had an older brother, too, a little more than a year older than you. Do you remember, as a boy, having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do or who I'm going to be?
Not at that age. In fact, it wasn't until I was in high school and getting ready to go to college that I knew the professions I wanted to follow, which were retailing and real estate, and actually did end up with a degree of majors in both those fields. I don't recall any specific episode in my early years, except that my brother was always beating up on me. He was 2.5 years older than I, but it wasn't really serious beating. It was just, brotherly love, as you call it.
I'm sure a lot of little brothers are nodding their head, including this one right here, because my brother was 5 years older than me. So you mentioned your father had served in World War I. Did he ever share any of his experiences with you or tell you anything about it?
Very little. He came over here when he was 4 years old. He was born in Italy also. I'm not sure exactly what his path was because I wasn't around, but he did. It was during the World War I, and he was hale, hearty, and I don't know, I guess he may have been just drafted into the service. But he never shared any experiences with me. As a matter of fact, he turned out to be a mess sergeant. So he was working, cooking food for the troops. And fortunately, that kept him away from front lines. So he survived World War I.
I'm glad you mentioned food, because I think every Italian-American World War II veteran I've ever interviewed had some stories about his childhood, even if it was during the Great Depression, and his mother cooking this amazing Italian cuisine. Do you have some memories of those Sunday dinners or the stuff your mom used to make?
I have a number of memories of the Depression days. We were really poor. As a matter of fact, I was in grammar school, and we couldn't afford to buy any lunch meat for sandwiches. So we created what I call a depression sandwich, which was French bread or dry sourdough bread, lettuce, a little olive oil, and that's the sandwich. I remember going to school and wrapping the wax paper. It was all oily because of the olive oil in it. But that was kind of a snapshot of the Depression. Also, we got to the point where I had an allowance of 15 cents a week. 10 cents was for a double feature movie, and 5 cents was for candy. And if one was judicious about the way he shopped for the candy, you could get enough candy to last you through 2 double features of the movie. But I remember those days of the Depression. Those were kind of tough times, but we made it through. There was always food on the table, thanks to my dad. And that's pretty much the story of my recollection of the Depression days.
Another thing that I don't want to forget to ask is about December 7th, 1941, because it seems like everybody who lived through that day has some kind of memory of how they found out. Do you have a memory of that Sunday?
Very much so. Sunday was pasta day around our house. My mother would cook up, I don't know how many pounds of pasta for my brother and me, and she and her and my dad. But we were having lunch on that Sunday around the kitchen table, and I remember hearing the news flash come over the radio about what happened at Pearl Harbor. And I know my mother was already kind of nervous because my brother was obviously a draft age and so on. Well, he was smart. He passed the test to take the training course that I took later on, which was 13 weeks of training to become an electronic technician, and graduated through that course and ended up on an island in the Pacific. I don't know where else we go from here.
Well, one thing that I think a lot of people still are unaware of, and I wouldn't know unless I'd had veterans tell me, is that here in the Bay Area, after Pearl Harbor, life changed in some ways that most of us couldn't identify with. Maybe it's old hat for you because you lived through it, but did you have to have blackout conditions, fearing the Japanese were going to attack the Bay Area?
Yeah, very definitely. We had no lights visible. We had blackout blinds. There were volunteer wardens that patrolled the areas. And if you didn't have your windows covered, he'd knock on the door and tell you, straighten out, cover up those windows. Yeah, because the fear was that there'd be some submarine attack off the coast, or shelling. In fact, I heard, I think, in Southern California, there was a submarine that actually fired on the coast. But anyway, that was the Pearl Harbor days, living under those conditions, blacking things out every night.
And had you had any friends in school who were Japanese American?
Yes, I had my closest buddy, a little Japanese boy. Kazuo Kato was his name, and we were in grammar school together. His family was in a cleaning business, clothes cleaning business. We were close buddies till we separated. When I went on to middle school, he went to a different school.
And do you know what happened to his family after Pearl Harbor?
I do not know. It's just not anything I was aware of. I was aware that Kazuo had to go to a different school, and I went on to grammar school and then middle, and as it goes from there to high school.
When did you start to think that you might become part of this war effort?
Well, obviously, I was aware of what happened, as we discussed, on the 7th of December. I had taken ROTC for 3 years in high school instead of gym. So I had military training. I was a captain in the ROTC. And I knew I could take that military training on with me into the Navy. You don't think of the Navy as marching around doing a manual of arms with their rifles. But in basic training, there was a lot of that as part of the disciplinary effort. So I ended up leading 250 guys. And here I am. I think I landed in boot camp at age 18. And I'm out there commanding this patrol of 250 guys marching around. I had to teach them the close order drill and the manual of arms. But that was the memories of early Navy life at the basic training.
And that was way up in the panhandle of Idaho, in Farragut, Idaho.
60 miles from the Canadian border.
Sounds like it might have been a little colder than you were used to in the bay.
Exactly. I landed at Farragut, Idaho on my 18th birthday. And here I was, never been out of California, sitting on a bunk in a barracks without anybody there. And I'm 18 years old, waiting for somebody to tell me what to do.
Any of the things you got to learn there or the experiences you had there stand out in your memory?
Well, yes, of course, I was familiar with the manual of arms and close order drill, so I was imparting that to my fellow mates. Actually, Farragut was really a big city. There were five camps, completely standalone camps. They had their own patrol with their parade grounds, pools, mess hall, and the whole works. In fact, they were running 25,000 sailors through there at one time. So that's pretty much my memory of Farragut. It was the obstacle courses that you had to participate in. I was in good shape when I finished basic training.
Well, I've seen some pictures that that back that up. And I'll share some of those on our Hometown Heroes website and Facebook page. Did you care what kind of ship you ended up on? Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do?
I had a definite idea. I wanted to be on a destroyer, and I wanted to be in the Pacific. And I got both wishes.
I haven't had too many guys say, I wanted to be on a destroyer, because a lot of times they were expendable. They were the first line of defense. Why was that a wish of yours?
Well, anyway, I just thought it was an exciting thing. They look like they were great ships, you know, they're sleek, they're fast, they can take care of themselves pretty much, except when the kamikazes showed up.
And we'll hear about that, but you went through some pretty detailed training before that that would lead to what your job on the ship was, right?
Correct. I qualified for a course of 13 months in electrical engineering and similar training. This course was divided in three parts. The first part was a month in Chicago, Illinois. That month was devoted to learning how to use a slide rule. That was the handheld computer of the day. Transistors had not yet been invented. It's amazing how many people could not pick that up. I was familiar with it from radio shop. I took radio shop for 3 years in high school. That was the first part of the washout. I mean, you made it through that, learn to use the slide rule, then you're equipped to go through the rest of the training. The next 3 months I spent at Texas A&M College Station, Texas. That was elementary engineering, study of antennas and radiation patterns. That was 3 months. And then fortunately for me, the next 7 months were at Treasure Island in California, an hour away from my home. So that was great duty for me, because on Friday afternoon, I could check out, come home, sleep in my own bed, have my mom's great cooking until Sunday afternoon. I zipped back to Treasure Island and back to the quarters.
That all sounds pretty safe, but then you end up going into a situation that wasn't so safe. Do you remember how you felt about shipping out and heading overseas?
Well, I was just barely 18 years of age, and I don't know if you're aware of the extreme sentiment against the Japanese for what they consider was a sneak attack. So the patriotism just was intense as it could be. I didn't have any qualms about going out to sea and going on a destroyer, because I'd been imagining that for a long time. You know, I was too stupid to know what I was going to be getting into. But anyway, it worked out pretty well.
How'd your mother feel about it? Was there a tearful goodbye there?
Yes, my mother had two stars in her. window, you know, my brother and myself, two sons in the service. It was hard on her, I'm sure, and to my dad. Fortunately, my brother's service was not as harrowing as mine because he was on an island and he was working some kind of a transmitting communications facility. But really, I had no idea what the heck I was getting into, but I was ready for it. You know, everybody was gung-ho, you know.
So give me a taste of that, the journey out to the Pacific and getting to know all these guys on your destroyer.
The story started when I was ordered to Pearl Harbor, to the destroyer base. I was there for about 2 or 3 weeks before they got transportation for me on another destroyer escort like my ship. So I took a ride from Pearl Harbor down to the Admiralty Islands in New Guinea. That was a long ride. It was the same ship, kind of ship that I had, was going to be on ultimately. So that was, I guess, the one interesting thing that stands out was crossing the equator for the first time. They were ruthless, you know, the guys who were already been there. So some of the exercise, I'll call it, that you went through was the initiation was a little bit on the rough side. That was quite an experience. So then I finally made it to my ship, which was berthed in New Guinea, in the Admiralty Islands. And from there we started doing escort duty, escorting carriers and all kinds of merchant ships around all of the Pacific Islands. We sort of followed invasion of these various islands and when they were established as ports of support for the rest of the effort. Oh, I remember we were with the carriers, and we would fish out the pilots who missed the deck, had to crash and get out of their plane. And so we rushed over, picked them up, and they would set up a breeches buoy, which is a conveyance for a human person from one ship to another. They fire over a line, then they fire a stronger line. And yet they put these guys in what's something like an inner tube, and they haul them up to the carrier. And they always used to send back about 6 gallons of ice cream. Thank you, thank you. And that was great because I love ice cream, and we didn't have an ice cream maker on our ship.
The incentive for picking up a down pilot, huh?
Oh, yes. They were pretty happy to see us, and we were just pleased as heck to be able to be part of that rescue thing.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Dick Biagi of Walnut Creek, California. Not only a couple of close calls involving enemy aircraft at Okinawa, but a decision his ship's captain made that may have saved all of their lives. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 99-year-old Dick Biagi of Walnut Creek, California. 80 years ago right now, he was aboard the destroyer USS Foreman in the Pacific. And why don't you tell us what your duties were aboard that tin can, Dick?
My rating or my rank was an electronic technician, and that involved full responsibility for repair and maintenance of anything electronic on the ship. And I'm talking not only a sonar and radar, but radio receiving equipment, transmitters. And then we had a piece of equipment which was highly secure, which was called IFF. And I'm sure you probably heard of it. It stands for Identification, Friend, or Foe. And that was a special piece of equipment, highly secure. As a matter of fact, they included a magnesium charge in the equipment in case it was going to be falling into enemy hands. You could pull this cord and it would ignite that magnesium charge. And magnesium flame is one of the hottest flames there is, and it would just melt that whole piece of equipment into one big blob.
And that's for the purpose of aircraft identifying themselves so you wouldn't shoot them down.
Yeah, the aircraft had a transmitter responder that would respond to our radar signal. We would see the identification show up on the radar blip, and we knew it was friendly. If we didn't get a return on that blip, battle stations were called, and we got ready for an attack.
And if general quarters sounded on the USS Foreman, where did that mean you had to go?
My battle station, if you will, was in the radar transmitter room. Actually, I'm sitting around the equipment that I always would maintain, some of it at least. And that was my battle station. So I was inside. I didn't see a lot of the things. I could hear it, but that was where my battle station was because I had to be close to the equipment.
Yeah, because if it stops working when you need it the most, that's when you're needed the most.
That's right, exactly.
Now, and you mentioned an array of different devices that you would have to know how to fix, but you didn't say anything about climbing the mast. And there's a picture here of a bare-chested young teenage sailor, pretty high up there. How did that unfold? What's the story there?
Well, the story there was our radar screen shows a white line that designates the forward direction of the ship. It's called the dead-ahead line. That line is controlled by a switch on the surface searchar antenna on the mast, 60 feet up above the deck. And as luck would have it, the timing was just worse as it could be. The switch went out as we were forming up the task force to go to Okinawa. And this happened in the harbor of the island of Ulithi. And it's a huge harbor. All of these ships for the task force getting ready to go out to sea and start the invasion. Well, the regulations prohibit going aloft when the ship is in motion. So I went to the division officer and I said, look, the ship is going to be blind without this identification line on the screen. We got to fix it, and we got to fix it right away because we don't have much time. So I want you to give me permission to go to aloft. And if you don't, I'm going to have to go up anyway because I want to save this ship. So he readily agreed that we should do it. So I climbed up and I had an assistant behind me to help out if I needed any help. With the position of the top of the mast 60 feet up, it amplifies any kind of swing in the water, any movement in the water. So I'm up there and my tools are rolling back and forth on this metal platform under the antenna. But long story short, I was able to uncover it, find the old switch, replace the switch, cover it back up, came down from the mast as we were clearing the breakwater and were ready to just on the way out to sea with the task force. So we had our eyes back on the radar, so that took care of it.
You got it just in the nick of time. I'm just wondering, because it's been 80 years since then, have you ever been on a roller coaster or any kind of ride quite like that one since?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, following the storms, typhoons as they called them, the orders were to sail in the opposite direction. But the storm left behind, I call them rollers, these waves that rolled around. And my pet pastime was sitting at the stern of the ship on the depth charges, 370 feet from the bow, and going over these rollers, as we called them. So it was a real ride, and I loved it. So if you got seasick, you'd never do that.
I was going to say, obviously, you had your sea legs going there. And you mentioned Okinawa, and it was happening 80 years ago right now. In fact, Easter Sunday was the start of that invasion. You guys got there ahead of that. You know, before we get into all that, I guess I neglected to ask a question that I should, which is, was there kind of a welcome to the war moment for you where you realized, hey, this might be a life or death situation for me and for my shipmates?
Yes, I would say that was the closest we came to being hit by a suicide plane. We lucked out because the suicide pilot had set his glide path. Again, we had seas that were up and down. Fortunately, we went down when he came over. So it was so close that he ripped off the railings on the bow of the front of the ship and then tore off his wing as he went over the side. And this huge explosion took place. And we were greeted by a raining of all of these parts of that plane that exploded next to us. I had retrieved some parts of that. And that was an oh-ho moment, or whatever you want to call it, because it was a question of inches, because they could have just torn our bow right off. But fortunately, they lost their wing, and that gasoline started pouring out, and that caused the flame and explosion that followed.
I want to come back around to the aftermath of that, but I'm thinking about ahead of time, because this is the week leading up to the land invasion at Okinawa. You guys are doing some pre-invasion shelling there. Had you been briefed, warned, heard through the grapevine about this idea of the suicide plane, the kamikaze threat?
Oh, yes, we'd heard a lot of it, quite a bit of it. In fact, one of our sister ships was virtually destroyed by a suicide flight. The suicide plane was in its glide, and it was getting close to the superstructure of that ship, and it carried a bomb. And apparently, the bomb was armed as the plane came in. So you've got an explosion, you've got gasoline, you've got a superstructure of a lightly clad destroyer that looked like a piece of Swiss cheese, followed by flaming gasoline. So we lost about 40 people in that sister ship's experience. And I made the mistake of going over looking at it when we got back to port to a destroyer tender. When I did that, I went to my battle station. I recall that was where one of my buddies who went through training like I did, he was at the same battle station as I did, and he was one of the 40 people that were lost in the explosion and fire. So that was an oh-ho moment. I knew what could happen. And whenever you get ready, you want to know, what did we do after that first close call that I described?
Yeah, and I want to hear that, but I don't want to miss the chance to talk more about what you just mentioned. Because a lot of times I ask people to imagine what would have happened. You're saying this is the sister ship, so the same class, exactly. Same function. He's performing the same exact role as you, so you could see and touch the spot where you would have been, and there's no doubt in your mind what would have happened to you.
Oh yes, no question. Everything was just blackened and had been completely burned out.
And do you remember that friend's name?
Yes, I think his last name was Cohen. I do remember that last name, and he was a casualty in that nobody escaped the superstructure because you had too many combinations of actions taking place at once. you had the explosion which pockmarked all the metal in the superstructure. You could see daylight through the holes. Then you had the explosion of the bomb and the gasoline going, you know, throughout the superstructure and going through those holes. You have to remember that the metal or the steel on a destroyer is not very heavy. That's why they call them tin cans.
Exactly. Not the safest place to be. And you said you made the mistake of going over and seeing. So now you know what you wish you didn't know. And then March 27th, 1945, this kamikaze's coming for you. Were you down below, or did you actually see this plane?
I was at my battle station, but I heard all of the commotion, and I realized afterward, when I was picking up pieces of that plane, what kind of an explosion it really was. It was close inboard, very close to us. I had no doubt as to what could happen after going over looking at one of our sister ships.
So what you have here, and I'll put some pictures, maybe a video, it kind of jingles a little bit when you pick up the Ziploc bag, because there's three or four different little pieces. You picked each one of these up off the deck of your ship when you went up to look at it?
Right.
Have you ever tried to figure out what those little pieces were?
All I know, they were part of a suicide plane that was ready to take us out. And it was a matter of inches, we escaped it. But this experience precipitated something very important that we did afterward. As a result of this attempted suicide attack, the captain smartly realized that we did not have a sufficient amount of close-in firepower. So what did he do? Apparently, we were in the harbor. He went over to an aircraft carrier where he had a buddy. Long story short, he comes back in the afternoon with our motor whaleboat loaded down with 16 50 caliber aircraft machine guns and all of the ammunition. So he radioed ahead to the ship as he was coming back to get their welding torches and out and be prepared to start creating 18 mounts for these machine guns. Not only did we put them along the main deck, but we also put one up in each of the lookout buckets. So we had seven at the main deck, one on each lookout bucket at the top of the bridge. It did the job because we survived three more direct suicide attacks by virtue of these machine guns. What we did was we just turned ourselves sideways to the oncoming plane as he reached the range of a 50 caliber machine gun. Nine of them on one side of the ship started firing, and they were a dead duck because there was close range and many, many machine guns firing at once. So the captain really deserved kudos for coming up with that solution.
Yeah, that's so fascinating, because a lot of times we hear about the mistakes in leadership, and here's potentially a life-saving decision that one captain made to protect you and all of your shipmates. Have you ever thought about that? What might have been different if he didn't do that?
Well, after seeing what happened to my sister ship, I was very, very aware of what might have happened if he didn't.
And a week after that near miss that you have some of the remnants of sitting right here, your ship was targeted. And this time a bomb was dropped right at your ship. And you were you down at your battle station for that too?
No, I was asleep in my bunk. But I was 8 feet away from where the bomb impacted, well, I should say penetrated the, it was one of the hatchways above the number one boiler room. Fortunately, it was an armor-piercing type bomb. In order for that bomb to explode, it has to hit a very substantial piece of metal. They really are created for battleships and heavier ships. So this thing goes right through our ship like a piece of Swiss cheese. I have a picture of it I'll show you later with the impact hole. Fortunately, It was above the boiler room, away from where the steam chest was located. The steam chest was located on the opposite side of the fire room, boiler room, I should say, from where this thing penetrated the upper surface of that compartment. If it hadn't been for that, if that was the opposite side, that steam chest would have armed that bomb immediately. Now, from there, it proceeded down through what's called the evaporation tubes. We used to make our own drinking water. The boiler was set up with a bunch of tubes, a large series, that had steam in them. They were small diameter. The steam evaporated and the water was created by the evaporation. That was our water supply. Well, anyway, it went through the tubes and that released steam in the fire in the boiler room. There were three chaps down there. One of them was very badly burned. He barely got out of the fire room. And then the bomb proceeded on down, penetrated the hull, missed the keel, which is a big steel girder, by about, I don't know how many inches, but I saw the hole in the hull later on. And then, of course, that entire room flooded. And fortunately, in destroyers, you have two of these boiler rooms. So we still had steam, we still had power. But anyway, that filled the number one boiler room to the waterline because it just penetrated the buoyancy.
There are a lot of questions that brings up, but it's time for our final break. 99-year-old Dick Biagi, our guest today. We're going to dive right back into that intense experience aboard the USS Foreman when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Dick Biagi of Walnut Creek, California. He's the only World War II veteran living at Viamonte, a senior living community which featured Dick's story in a recent newsletter. His neighbor there, Brian Servatius, quite the World War II history buff, read that and befriended Dick. And then he mentioned his story to his old college roommate, who happens to be my father-in-law. I don't always get to share how we end up connecting to the veterans we get to meet here on Hometown Heroes, but that was a fun connecting of the dots. And I know I'm grateful for it as we listen to Dick explain events from 80 years ago as if they took place last week. When we left off, Dick was telling us about a Japanese bomb that passed all the way through his ship on April 3rd, 1945, near Okinawa. Miraculously, only two sailors lost their lives. The ship was spared, but in definite need of repair.
They brought in some Navy divers. They had a device, I guess, which I would describe as an umbrella. And the guy on the outside took this umbrella, I'm going to call. And when he got below the hole, he opened this umbrella and pushed what I'll call the handle up through the hole. And his buddy on the inside took a hold of that, tied a line to it, and drew it up tight, and that became an emergency patch. So we were able to vacate the boiler room by pumping out the water from there, and then we went to a rear area, got in a drive dock, and they did a permanent repair.
You know, I'm just imagining being in your shoes, and as you just described, I know everyone's listening, they're saying, well, that could have happened, that could have happened, that could have happened. It's like the bullet that goes through your entire torso and doesn't hit any vital organs. It sounds like that's what this bomb was.
It was, yes. The vital organ that it needed was something heavy, a heavy weight of steel. I think the closest of the penetrated the hull a few inches away from the keel was really the lucky part of the whole thing.
I read that two of your shipmates were killed in that, but it also said that all the lights on the ship went out. So did this wake you up, or tell me how you experienced it?
Well, I was asleep and I heard this tremendous bang. Then the battle station alarm went off. I tried to get to my battle station because I was in one compartment removed from the boiler room. And I did make it up, we call them ladders or stairway, to the level above that boiler room where the guys were just trying to extricate themselves from the steam coming from the evaporation tubes. So it was pretty rough on those three guys.
Well, it sounds like it could have been rough for you. Did you say the bomb passed through 8 feet from where you were sleeping?
Yes. Fortunately, it was one compartment. There was a compartment wall separating where I was from the boiler room.
Because if that bomb hits you on the way down, it's moving plenty fast to take you out.
Oh, yes. There won't be an explosion, but
we're not having this conversation. Wow. And you said you were thankful for what your captain did with installing all those 50 caliber machine guns on the ship because there were three future kamikaze attacks. Were the other ones enough to raise your eyebrows too, or is this old hat for you by then?
It happens very rapidly. And again, I'm in inside quarters, so I can't see it. But I can hear the gunfire and so on. I know something's going on because you have eight of those 50 caliber things firing off at one time. Metal carries sound, you know, and it really is a racket, I'll tell you. I have a picture of one of our guys in the lookout bucket holding one of these machine guns if you want to see it.
And I'll post these all online. So you get through this insane kamikaze threat at Okinawa, but the war's not over yet. Were there any moments or things that happened between Okinawa and VJ Day that stand out in your memory?
Not really. We were so concerned in getting the ship totally repaired, so we went to a rear area where there was a floating dry dock and we could get all this work done. I don't know how much damage was caused to the boiler system. The steam chest was intact. It was the evaporation tubes that were all ripped up. That required that we get out of the battle zone and go to a rear area where we could get repaired. That was the memory I had after the bomb. It was a pleasant memory because we were going to a rear area and getting patched up.
And what about when you heard the news that Japan had surrendered, that this whole thing is actually over?
Everybody was just so joyous. It was a fantastic day. We received the news by, I guess at that time, it would have been a teletype or some similar equipment, and it was posted on the bulletin board, and everybody was happy as could be. My service there wasn't over because we ended up, this is another episode, but we ended up going into one of the large islands and escorting the occupation troops. And that's kind of a little humor in that story, and I'll tell you about it. We move into, oh, by the way, first ships ever there, there was a minesweeper ahead of us, making sure there were no mines in the path that we're going to be traveling. So we get to our position, and the captain comes on the speaker, and he says, okay, guys, you've escorted the troops. It's up to them to go in and occupy, so I'm going to declare liberty. So we get dressed up in our undressed whites, as they call them, pile into the motor whale boat, and alongside us are the landing crafts with the ramp up, and all of these army guys, their helmets and rifles poking up over the edge of the raft. So we're sitting there waving at them, and they're so damn mad at us. We're going on liberty, and they're going to occupy.
Did you see anything that stood out in terms of post-war Japan?
Well, as far as Okinawa was concerned, there was a lot of shelling that took place, and these towers I have photos of, they're just barely standing. There's so many holes in them, and there was a burial ground nearby, which we also saw when we went ashore.
That sounds like a sobering experience.
Yes, it was. But, you know, it's amazing. I guess it's a question of years and attitude and that sort of thing. I never did think of how lucky am I to be here until I got older.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that, and I may in a moment. But coming back to the States, what was it like to come home again, and what do you remember about that reunion with your family?
Well, it was sort of a halfway happy thing. We were expecting to come to San Francisco. For some reason or another, they decided to have us go to San Diego because the objective was we're going to go through the canal up the East Coast to Yorktown, Virginia, to unload ammunition and that sort of explosives and things of that nature. So we go to San Diego. Well, I got a 72-hour pass, couldn't get any flights. As a matter of fact, the only conveyance I got was a Greyhound bus, and I had to sit on my suitcase all the way from San Diego to the Bay Area, but I was damned happy to do it. So I had 72 hours to see my family and get back again.
And you used the GI Bill to go earn degrees at Cal in real estate and marketing. You end up becoming the national real estate manager for Lucky Supermarkets. Met your wife, two daughters, your grandchildren. Now you've got great-granddaughters. A lot of life in the 80 years since World War II. When you think back on just some of the stories you've shared with me today and what you survived, do you ever pinch yourself? Do you ever wonder why or if maybe somebody was looking out for you there?
Well, a combination of all of that, I guess. Obviously, I feel very fortunate to have survived all of this stuff, you know. And then secondly, I've been blessed with reasonably good health. I've had some accidents and so on along the way, but survived them. I'm spending as much time as I can in our gym here. We have a great fitness center. Fitness centers have been part of my life for a long number of years.
Well, you may have just answered my question, at least partially, because I'm just thinking of everyone who's hearing you. And if they were sitting right here with you like I am, they'd think the same thing. There's no way this guy's 99 years old and almost 100. So I was going to ask what your secret is. What do you think has enabled you to stay so sharp and active?
Well, I think the physical activity is so important because I've always been near a facility, a gym facility, and taking advantage of it. As far as health, by fluke, I don't drink, and I never did smoke. I came close to it, but didn't do it. That's another story. I think clean living has a lot to do with it, and activity. Active life and clean living in terms of, you know, not smoking and too much alcohol or something like that.
So don't drink, don't smoke, and eat olive oil and lettuce sandwiches?
Yes. That'll get you through the recession.
Well, and you said there's a story, so I've got to ask you. You almost started smoking. What stopped you?
Well, we had been out for almost 90 days. We were starting to run out of things. So they brought the canned spam out, and lo and behold, they ran out of cigarettes. You have to remember, you have these battle-hardened guys that were heavy smokers and really addicted. And I could not believe, by the way, this is about the time I thought, well, maybe I'm going to try this smoking thing. I watched these guys turn into animals. They were stealing from each other. I thought to myself, my God, if that's what happens, I'm not going to have anything to do with the smoking thing. So I just cut that whole thought out of my mind right then and there.
I can see why. If there's anything I haven't asked you about that you want to share, feel free. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a really incredible story that nobody else could tell us. I have to ask, have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington?
Yes.
What was that like, to see that wall of gold stars, to see all the other displays?
I was very happy because I felt it was appropriate, and it's a very lovely monument. It's a large circular courtyard-like. Very large, beautifully done. All the states are all represented. I was happy to see it. My late wife and I traveled back there. I had a friend that I also did some business for Lucky in Washington. I had the opportunity to go back there and see this monument, not only that, but all the others, the Vietnam Wall and all of the Iwo Jima Monument, all of the memorabilia from that big war.
When you looked at that wall of gold stars, where underneath it says, "Here we mark the price of freedom," and there are 4,000 of those stars representing over 400,000 guys like you who didn't get to come home, what kind of thoughts went through your mind taking that in?
Well, I'll tell you, it just flashed through our mind. I was so happy to see that they had done an appropriate job of memorializing this huge happening that we all went through. I had many times thought how lucky I was to still be alive because of losing shipmates and things like that. So I didn't dwell on that all that much. I just thought it was such an appropriate thing to do, and I was happy that they did it.
I don't know if this is an easy question or not. It's a long time ago, 80 years ago this year. Is there something you think today's world, today's America, can learn from the America that you experienced in World War II?
It's hard to say, Paul. I think the thing that bothers me more than anything is the ingratitude that is displayed, especially by our younger generation. I think somehow or other we've got to get through to them and let them see or imagine what we all went through to keep the country free. I didn't feel I was patriotic or anything like that. I didn't think about it at the time, but reflecting, I do. But I guess that's the one concern I have, is the younger generation, because I have 5 great-grandkids that are going to be coming along, and I'm concerned about what kind of a world will they be living in.
Well, and like I said, if there's anything else you want to add, please do so. But the last question I have, you're getting ready to turn 100 years old. When you think back over almost a century on this planet, from the little kid who got sent home from school because he couldn't speak English, to the guy who's speaking English better than most people half your age right now, when you think back over all those years, is there something you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful for, number one, for good health, because I wouldn't be here if I didn't have good health. That's a result of my earnest physical activity. Other than that, I guess from time to time, I think you're pretty damn lucky to be around and be able to see some of these young offspring grow and get to know them. That's the one thing we're going to have to work on, is I want to get to know those grandkids better than I have, because of just circumstances. They have preschool to do, the parents work, you know, and things like that. But I'd like to work on getting closer to my grandkids.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I appreciate your taking the time, Paul. It's very good of you to dwell into the past, particularly my past, and I think it's a great thing that you're doing.
Well, and maybe it's something we can all do a little of this weekend as families gather for the holiday. Every veteran has a story, so if there's a veteran at your table, maybe you can start a conversation that may just take you down some paths like Dick Biagi guided us through today. Check out photos and a brief video with Dick at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.